Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2003. Today's session is Government for Sale, Special Interest Money and the Buying of Favored Treatment, Session 3 of Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
This talk is about, the title was Government for Sale, and I apologize, I can't remember what the subtitle of it was, but it's a talk about the impact of big money on the political process and what, if anything, we should do about it. I'm John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota who's experienced a lot of races of my own and watched how money in politics works, and have been spending a lot of my time in the legislature trying to address the impact of big money in politics. And I first got elected in 1986, in November of 86, and one of the first letters of congratulation I got, there are lots of interesting things that happen if you're first elected to office. Everybody starts writing you, the honorable. How come I was all of a sudden the honorable? Because I got more votes than my opponent. Would he have been more honorable if he had gotten more votes? But one of these letters, about 3 days after the election, was from a lobbyist who wrote me a note, and this is, I've memorized it, I still have the letter, it's a gem of a letter. It says, what a, congratulations on your election and told how hard work pays off and that sort of thing. And he said, one of my clients had the misfortune of having donated money to your opponent. Here's the contribution as they wish to make amends. Misfortune? What kind of misfortune? Make amends? What are they making amends for? And in their mind, I presume, and again, I can't know for sure what the lobbyist was thinking, but I assume they gambled. They were investing in this new state senate person they thought was going to win, and they blew it. They weren't picking him because if they gave to him and now thought it was a mistake and were giving it to me, they weren't doing it because they thought he was better for, he would have been a better senator for the serving the state of Minnesota than otherwise. He'd be better for their particular industry. Just simply that they wanted to have access to the person in office and they gave money to him and they blew it. They guessed the wrong person and so they were making amends. And then this year, there have been a couple months ago in Minnesota, and I use Minnesota examples predominantly because that's the experience I've had, but there are plenty of others at the national level and every state has the same problem. Insurance company called American Bankers Insurance. It's not one of the good guy insurance companies that doesn't rip people off. It's one that's been fined in many states for violations, fraudulent policy types of things where they're selling a meaningless policy at rip-off prices and they're misleading consumers. And the State Department of Commerce was going after them, and it had been a 2-year investigation, and they were interested in a $10 million fine. I think they were actually talking $5 to $6 million fine and kicking the firm out of the state. You cannot sell insurance in Minnesota anymore. And the insurance company had agreed tentatively, they were saying the maximum they were willing to pay out in the civil fine was $3.5 million and a 5-year ban on being kicked out of the state. And last August, this is 2002 election year, the company was coming in for what the state thought was signing the final papers on this. They had a couple little things to negotiate, but the company simply said, we're not talking anymore, and walked out. And a month later, they made generous campaign contributions, $10,000 followed by a $5,000 check, to both the Democratic and Republican candidate. And remember, the governor, the past governor of Minnesota, was an Independence Party governor, and his party had somebody else running. So there were three major candidates. So they gave money to two of the three candidates. And they couldn't give it directly to the candidates. They hired a lobbyist to implement a political strategy, is what they called it. And in a report, an investigation on this, the insurance company attorney said they were trying to, quote, do whatever we can to ensure that Commissioner Bernstein, the head of the department that was negotiating this fine with them, that he goes, and we'll take our chances on whomever the next commissioner is going to be, because it can't be any worse than trying to negotiate a settlement with the current guy. So they were trying to give $15,000 to the Democratic candidate, the Republican candidate, and take their chances that they'd appoint a better, more favorable commissioner. And they couldn't. They found out they can't give it directly to the candidates. They couldn't even give it to the parties because it would be an illegal corporate contribution in Minnesota. So they got advice from the two parties, which were more than eager to give it to them, saying, hey, you could launder the money through the national parties where there isn't the prohibition. And does the laundering work? Yeah, the legislative audit report came up with a copy of a letter the state Republican Party chairman sent to the lobbyists for the American Bankers Insurance, thanking them for their first of the checks, the $10,000 one. So they clearly laundered the money through here and get it back there. What did they get for their $15,000, the Democratic Party, $15,000, the Republican Party? Well, you can't prove anything. I mean, unless they say, yeah, we did it, and the new governor comes in and says, yeah, we gave them a sweetheart deal because they gave us money. Unless you have that, sir, then you can't prove any of this. It's all speculation, perhaps, they would say. They came up with a final settlement instead of $3.5 million, of $2 million. And of that, instead of it being a $2 million fine, they labeled it as a $200,000 fine with a $1.8 million reimbursement for investigative expenses. Well, I asked the former commissioner how much they spent because they had billed him separately for an outside firm doing the investigation. How much the department internally spent on investigation? Would it have been $1.8 million? No, it was less than $100,000, clearly. So it's a scam bookkeeping thing, which they, I assume, can write off on their taxes. So the taxes they would have paid on the $1.8 million is gone. In every other state that's looking at fines, they see it on the books as a $200,000 fine instead of $2 million. And at the minimum, it was a fine of $2 million instead of $3.5 million. So savings $1.5 million in exchange for $30,000 contribution. You see why somebody might take their chance and make campaign contributions. The legislative auditor, which is a nonpartisan, very cautious group, they in their report, they quote the state attorney general saying they, the insurance company, made those contributions for the purpose of getting a favor, and they got one. And the auditor says, we could not substantiate the commissioner and the attorney general's allegation, but we did establish American Bankers obtained settlement terms that were more favorable than any previously offered to it by the state. OA's previous offer relative to the amount American Bankers would be required to pay was $3.5 million. Well, was there an impact or not? We can't prove it, and therefore the auditor's report even suggests, well, it's okay. You know, that's the way the process worked. The attorney general said, yeah, sure, they have the right to make campaign contributions. Well, not legally in Minnesota, but, well, we can legally launder it through Washington. You can't prove it, but, well, before I get into more, let me define what I'm talking about, special interest money or big money influencing the political process. I'm suggesting almost anything could have an impact on somebody's political beliefs. I ran for governor 10 years ago, and the spending limit at that time, and still now, is pretty close to $2 million. And if trying to raise that money, if you're raising it in $10 chunks, you couldn't possibly remember who gave you the money. You raise it in $2,000, $3,000 chunks, people, it's a little more memorable. And if you do it in $10,000, $100,000 kind of contributions, people remember where they get money. And the candidates, oh, I don't know. The candidates in Washington often, they have congressional offices, they have a partisan office nearby Capitol Hill, so over lunch hour they can go there and make phone calls, dialing for dollars. Is very blatant, and almost every candidate does it, and they have to because of the way the system's set up. I, for my own races, have determined that I'm not going to accept special interest money, and I defined it as I would not take anything over $100, no lobbyist money, no PAC money, no soft money, which is the money you give to the party or somebody else instead, and then they spend the money on your behalf. That's what the McCain-Feingold effort was trying to get after. And so I suggest anything where somebody's trying to get some advantage for their contribution, or where they're giving a large contribution and whatever. I personally have decided I think $100 strikes me as a goal we should be aiming for. So I've run my campaigns that way. And in Minnesota, like in a handful of states, four or five states, there is a public subsidy available to candidates who agree to a spending limit. So there is some public money available to candidates. Well, how big of a problem is it? If any of you were at the forum last night, I quoted Bill Moyers, who wrote a cover story for Sojourners magazine a couple years ago, which was titled, "Big Money's Assault on Democracy is Not as Bad as You Think, period." I can guess the next two words, it's worse. And Bill Moyers, who has a good read on the political system, who spent time as an insider on the political system, has been covering it intensively for 40 years, he says that's the case. Well, voters agree with that. Common Cause, the government reform group, took a poll in Minnesota about 5 or 6 years ago, and a question, are politicians more responsive to campaign contributors than to voters who do not contribute? Margin wasn't 60-40 or 55-45, it was 88-6. People said, yes, we think they're more responsive to campaign contributors than they are to the ordinary citizen. That suggests it's destroying confidence in government, even if it's only a perception of corruption. It's destroying confidence in government. But that's the public view and the Bill Moyers view. The people inside the political system, including the lobbyists, including the public officials, including the political pundits, sometimes even some of the reporters, they would argue it's just a public perception problem. Yeah, the public sees this. I tried a few years ago to try and stop lobbyist contributions to elected officials, or report them all at least. And that was this year. That year was an attempt to get reporting of it. And I suggested that, you know, this is an important thing. If somebody is paid full time to be there trying to influence the way I behave, shouldn't they have to report a contribution? The state limit right now is anything over $100. Means a $100 contribution doesn't get reported. One of my colleagues said, that could give people a bad impression. You know, what if I take a $100 contribution from a lobbyist who happens to be a friend or somebody I agree with on things, and I vote for something that lobbyists would like, and, people might get the wrong impression that I voted that way because they gave me a $100 contribution. And I said, so the solution to that is don't let them know about it, which is basically what we have now. So they can give them lobbyists. Some lobbyists give $100 to virtually everybody they can think of to give $100 to. And it doesn't show up on any report. It's an unitemized contribution. And they have a little bit of access, I would argue. But the politicians are convinced the public is ill-informed and they don't understand how the process works. And therefore, it's not a problem, it's just a perception of a problem. We should try and change the perception as if maybe we should run advertising campaigns saying, we're not crooked. And whenever you try legislation to try and change this, the common response is, hey, I'd never sell my vote for contribution. I'm not going to do this. I'm not corrupt. I'm not a crook. And in truth and in fairness, very, very few of my colleagues in Minnesota, and I would hope and guess it's true in most states, if you offered somebody $1,000 in cash under the table, either for campaign contribution or as a gift, most politicians, and said, here, take this, and I hope you'll vote for this thing here, most politicians would get out of there quickly and say, I don't want anything to do with this, and chase them out of the office or whatever. They're not dishonest people. They're human beings, however, and my whole point is, while there are some crooks, we basically have a corrupt system. Who's right, the public opinion or the insiders? I would argue the public perception is generally correct. I think the public perception may be more often, oh yeah, they take the money under the table and they vote for this, that there is a quid pro quo. You give me this, I give you that. And that described that, I think, in most cases as inaccurate. And even if it was only a perception of corruption, I think that destroys the credibility of the democratic process. But I go beyond it. I say it really, truly, they're not buying and selling votes. They're buying and selling access and influence and goodwill. We're taught from early childhood on, somebody gives you a gift, you send them a thank you letter. You'd be grateful to them. But we basically set up a system here where somebody gives you, in this case, $10,000, $15,000 in the American Bankers case, and, oh, you're going to be a total ingrate. You shouldn't even send them a thank you letter. I mean, for heaven's sake, you don't want them, you just, we're going to keep it totally separate. Nope, I got this contribution. I almost don't know who it was from. You know, and, but that's not human nature. I like to use the argument for people who think, oh, well, people aren't bought by things like that. That 20 years ago with the airports, the Hare Krishna folks, they'd give you a cheap carnation. They'd probably spend 20, 30 cents for a wholesale. And they'd hand it to you, and, no, I'm sorry, I'm not interested. And, yes, I insist. It's a gift from me to you. And, okay, you take their flower and keep brushing on it, and they keep walking along with you. And, you know, would you be willing to make a $10 contribution to our ministry? And nobody did $10, but a lot of people gave them $2 or $3 and $4. Why? Because, well, you know, somehow you could brush them off, but once you took something from them, in Psychology 101 textbooks on reciprocity, we feel a human urge to repay people. And I would accuse politicians of being human, not of being crooks, though there are some crooks. Well, how does it corrupt the process? Well, it determines who runs for office. When you look back, our current president, when he was running, his chief competition in the end was John McCain. Before that was Elizabeth Dole. Elizabeth Dole dropped out early. What was the reason? She was less articulate, less personable, less thoughtful, less, no. I'm not in either her or George Bush's camp, but I think most people would argue she was more articulate, perhaps more thoughtful. The reason she dropped out was lack of money. She had a lot of money, just it wasn't the same amount, the same quantity. Even more than who runs for office, it determines who wins office. And I can give you plenty of proof. First time I ran, I abided by our state spending limit. My opponent did not. So he outspent me by more than 50%. Paul Wellstone, first time he ran, he was outspent like 6-1. Those exceptions happen where people win, but it's the exceptions, I would argue, that prove the rule. And to the candidates who say, oh, no, the fact that I got more money makes me win, that's not really the case. Well, if it's true that the amount of money doesn't make a difference, why don't you switch them out to treasuries? Hey, if I got $3 million, my opponent's got $1 million, why don't I give him the $3 million, take his $1 million, and then it shouldn't make any difference because it doesn't determine who runs. Of course it determines who wins. What issues are raised? Candidates shy away from certain controversial issues that may be popular with the public but are not popular with certain groups. If you want to talk about health care reform, you know, I think you take a poll on how many believe working people should have affordable health care as a right in this country. You got 80%+ of the public, which is a landslide in political terms, but last presidential election, neither major party candidate would even talk about the issue. You don't talk about certain issues or certain strategies because of the money, because of who you can do it. It determines how the issues are framed. And it's not just the candidates running the ads. It's the independent groups, the third parties. It's the political parties themselves running groups. And they frame very much which issues are talked about and which are sold to the public as most important. But I would argue that the money has a major impact on who gets elected in our democracy. And then once people are in office, it influences how they behave. Gifts and favors to public officials. I sponsored, after about 6 years, successfully sponsored a bill that banned gifts from lobbyists and public officials in Minnesota, gifts from lobbyists and interest groups to public officials, which was highly, and still is highly controversial among elected officials. Why do we need this? And, oh, and the public doesn't think we need to do this. Well, most of the public that I talk to, they think it's a bizarre idea that strangers give you gifts. Why would a stranger give you gifts? I worked on that, but gifts and favors to public officials, money has an impact that way. Money has an impact by a perpetual lobbying force that surrounds people at the Capitol. Just by being there, just by presence, they're going to have clout. And in a democracy, people are entitled to try and gain clout. I only argue that they shouldn't be able to buy extra advantages by campaign contributions, gifts, and so on. They also generate what's been called the last few years astroturf lobbying. as opposed to real grassroots things where hundreds of people write letters and postcards. They generate their own. It's artificial grassroots stuff. And I saw this when I was first at the Tobacco Institute, started doing this. They had six or seven, this was pre-computerized, not the average citizen didn't have word processors then. And so they had six or seven dummy letterheads, and they were all the same. And after you started getting hundreds of them, you recognized their patterns. Hey, how come we get so many with this interesting kind of letterhead? I mean, the letterhead just had their name and address and different typefaces and so on it. But they send them out, and more now with the internet, people, I've seen some environmental groups send out things that, oh, just fill in this here. But it's often a phony grassroots thing where they generate public pressure. And then the biggest single one, the campaign contributions, or the implied promise of future contributions, or for that matter, jobs. I mean, how many public officials leave, not just elected ones, but Minneapolis's community development agency director a few years ago negotiated a, depending on how you count it, $30, $40 million subsidy for a development agency, and 3 months later she left the development agency and went to work for the developer. Very lucrative vice presidential job, big developer, and massive pay raise. And was there a connection? Well, to me it didn't pass the smell test. But campaign contributions, this June, Friday afternoon, the President of the United States went to a reception in Greensboro, Georgia. I don't know where Greensboro is. I'm not from near Georgia. I'm sure it's a decent-sized city. Raised $2.2 million in reception. Stop in, shake hands, take pictures of people. $2.2 million later, you leave. The following Monday, he raised $5 million at the $2,000 plate dinner. $5 million. They're talking about raising perhaps $250 million in the campaign. That's not people who make $20,000 a year making $2,000 contributions. It's not people making $50,000 a year. It's frankly not people making $100,000 a year. It tends to be people who are well off. And you look at the policies, the tax policies we get. The Bush tax proposal this year, the top 1% of Americans are going to get cuts averaging $100,000 a year. Most people don't make $100,000. They don't pay $100,000 in taxes, so they couldn't get a $100,000 tax cut. That's at a time when we've got a growing federal budget deficit. We've got a lot of other things happening. Is it really wise to give anybody a $100,000 a year tax cut? And you know, it's a lot easier if you're getting $100,000 in less taxes. It's very smart to give $2,000 here and $2,000 there to your favorite candidates who push those. But I don't think it makes sense. And are they trying to get something as favors? The lobbyist for this American Bankers Insurance, who came in to help, who was hired by them after the scandal, after they were negotiating the settlement to solve their political problems. That's his mode of operation, give money to the Democrats and to the Republicans, and you buy friends on both sides. He and many other people, and I can just freely ask, is anybody in here ever in the same election given money to both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? Not to a candidate, not for, oh, I'm gonna support this guy for governor and this woman for Congress and this one, we pick parties and so on. Those are what you call independent voters, and they cross party lines many times, and most voters do. And some of them may give money to both those types, but have you ever seen people who give money to, and would you ever think of giving money to, like in our case, the Democratic Senate caucus and the Republican Senate caucus, who are running candidates against each other in the same year? You wouldn't do that, but the lobbyists do, and it's a routine thing. You give money to both sides, it's called hedging your bets, I suppose. Well, why would you do that? Because, if you give money to a political party, it's because you presumably have something in common with them. Consider yourself a member of it, or at least you share the values with it. You want to help their cause, so you give them money. And the Minnesota Twins owner a few years ago, when they first started their campaign to get a public subsidy, I dug out some things showing that the owner and his sons had given about $18,000 to one party's legislative caucuses and about 16,000 to the other one. And all the checks seemed to be coming in the same dates. And it looked like the owner and his sons had just sat down, okay, I'll write a $3,000 check to the House Republicans, and you write a $3,000 check to the House Democrats. And they sat down in a room on this. And when this came out in the papers, a reporter asked the twins' lobbyist, well, what's going on here? And he said, well, this isn't a partisan issue. We've seen it as sort of a bipartisan sort of thing. And I said, yeah, they're giving new meaning to the word bipartisan. They're trying to buy both parties. And it doesn't always result in success. That year they failed, though they've tried many times since then, and they seem to be getting closer to getting it. I think in a democracy, this is destructive. I don't think it's acceptable. What do we do? Well, I'll talk briefly about solutions before opening it up. It's about halfway through the hour, so I want to open it up quickly. But the solutions, there's often a debate. Do we need disclosure, or do we have to ban the sources of money? I think disclosure is a good thing, and I've favored much stronger disclosure laws and consistently have authored and supported other initiatives to increase disclosure. And politicians in Minnesota, at least, always say, oh, we've got some of the toughest disclosure laws in the country. Because in the mid-70s, we were one of the first states to have, but we're weaker than most other states, and pretty poor disclosure laws. But I, the fact that disclosing American bankers' insurance, that came out after the election, after the settlement, when an investigative reporter found it. But bottom line is, hey, I can look up and see anybody who gave $10,000 or $15,000 to either of the parties in Minnesota. I can look those things up. It's available for the public, but frankly, the public and the reporters, even if you do have disclosure, even if it is disclosed before the election, okay, George Bush got a lot of money from energy industry people. That was clear before the election. But that becomes one news story, and then in effect the money buys ad after ad after ad and campaign advantage after campaign advantage. And I know when I ran for governor in 94, again with nothing more than $100 contributions, we not only just spend a lot more time raising the money that way, but I was hoping, well, maybe I'd get one news story on it saying how, hey, at least I'm not taking the special interest money. And our CBS affiliate TV station has spent 2 days covering the big money going to the Democratic and the Republican U.S. Senate candidates, 1 day on each. Here's where the money's coming for her, here's where the money's coming from him, all the big contributions. But they didn't do one on the gubernatorial race that year because our campaign wasn't taking any, and they'd only be able to do one side of it. And I thought, well, maybe they should do a story on that. We expected at least a story kind of thing. But no, they didn't, and yet the other side gets the advantage of the big money. Is disclosure good enough? I think disclosure's necessary but not sufficient to address the problem. I think we should limit contributions. And I'll get in 1 minute real briefly about constitutionality. Because we've been trying sometimes piecemeal approaches, I've been frustrated at the speed of trying that, and I read somewhere about 4 years ago, about Westminster, Colorado. I don't even know where in Colorado Westminster is, if any of you are from there, maybe.
Yeah, I know, it's right there, it's just north of, there's one Westminster, it's just north of Denver.
That would be the one, I'm sure, but anyhow, two city council members there got frustrated with what they saw. Developers were making contributions to city council and getting zoning changes that they liked. And these guys passed an ordinance that I thought was great. Why can't we do it at the state level? And it was simply determining, we have laws on conflict of interest where you're not supposed to vote on things where you have a conflict. And theirs was that they defined it that if some campaign contribution of over $100, if you accepted one, you weren't banned from accepting it. They weren't trying to ban people from giving the money. But if somebody gave you more than $100, you couldn't vote on any issue that they were in effect meeting with the city council on. It's a little trickier to do that at the state level because the state deals with so many more issues than that. But I've introduced a bill, I haven't done much with it yet because I haven't had a hearing on it. I've asked for one for 2 or 3 years now. But I haven't pushed hard enough for it, saying, if we If a public official wants to accept larger contribution, fine. But if they accept it, then they shouldn't be voting on issues affecting that. Well, then people, oh, what if the labor will start giving money to anti-labor candidates so that they can't vote on labor issues, or business will start giving them to anti-business candidates or whoever. Well, no, this is if you accept it. They can offer anything you want, but you can return any contributions you don't want. I think that's a creative way to do it. I thought these guys in Colorado were thinking pretty cleverly, but haven't worked on that. There are ways you can do it, partial steps, and I favor partial steps. I favor actually a comprehensive plan, but at the federal level, the McCain-Feingold one, I would argue, made a big step forward in one way if it's ever fully implemented, and that is that the soft money, the money channeled through political parties. When I ran for governor, I got the party nomination, won the primary, and in exchange for getting the party nomination, oh, the party has all these services available to candidates. Well, they're not free. Somebody has to pay for them, and the party basically relies on the candidates to get on the phone and, yeah, so-and-so, you've given me $1,000 or $2,000, the limit. I really appreciate that. Would you be willing to give $20,000 if you figure out how much money the individual has or the interest has? And could you give $20,000 on behalf of the party? And you do that. We negotiate with the party that we were going to buy basically $100,000 worth of services and get out the vote phoning and voter identification and things like that, various services you get. And we were paying $100,000, but we didn't call up. I said we weren't taking soft money. Our little $15 and $25 and $100 contributions, we gather them in, and then we were writing checks of $20,000 out of them to the party, so because we weren't taking the big money, which didn't help politically at all, and didn't get credit for it. But the soft money is the thing where if you can only give $2,000 to a congressional or a gubernatorial campaign or something, well, then you give $50,000 is more common the case, or at the presidential level, $100,000, $200,000, you give it to the parties and they spend it on the candidate. It's generally a soft laundry type of laundering of money. McCain-Feingold was saying, hey, we're gonna clamp down on the soft money. But when you're talking partial steps forward, McCain-Feingold had what I consider a partial step backward. It doubled the amount of hard money you can give. If you can give basically $2,000 per person, $4,000 a couple, to a congressional candidate over the course of an election cycle, we doubled the amount of that at the federal level in the same bill. Bush can raise $2,000 a crack a person instead of $1,000 in hard money that way, as can every Democratic opponent of his. You know, when the one party chair, and I would argue both political parties in Minnesota have not been very forthcoming on this issue, a couple years ago, one of the party chairs came in and said, oh, the problem with our big money in politics is that there's too many limits. We just need more disclosure. And he said rather than $2,000 or $500 limits and so on, he would rather we repeal them. And if you need a limit, $25,000. He thought that was a limit. I mean, frankly, I looked down my street and I'm in a suburban neighborhood. It's not a poor neighborhood. I don't think anybody on my street has given a $2,000 contribution to any candidate for office anywhere, let alone $25,000. He thought $25,000 was a limit. McCain-Feingold is increasing that, and some people think more hard money is the solution. I think more money is not the solution. Bigger picture, I've tried to build for several years. We got part of it 10 years ago and not much since then. But to ban all what I call special interest money, all the PAC money, the obvious money, soft money, and anything over $100 in exchange for, Minnesota already has public financing. I probably get a third half my spending or the money I spend on from public subsidy. I was gonna even that out because I got more than some, less than some others, but even that out so everybody got a little bit more, or the higher ones would have gotten less, but everybody got a decent chunk of money in exchange for agreeing to a spending limit. Minnesota, virtually 100% of the candidates agreed to spending limits in legislative races since 1988, when I carried a change that basically increased the incentives by tying your incentive to what your opponent's behavior was. We've had I think in legislative races, only one, the former Vice President Mondale's son violated the spending limit. We had limits of $50,000, he spent $250,000. And his opponent was freed from the limit under the law, and she spent a lot too. But other than that one time, one race in 15 years, I think every other candidate has abided by the limit. And gubernatorial candidates, it's just now breaking away from it because the limits aren't, because they can get more around and get around the process. But I think if we replace our big money contributions with, first of all, a comprehensive system in campaign finance, you get a little bit here. You clamp down on PAC money here. Okay, your money goes out here. Clamp down on soft money, the hard money goes. Clamp down on hard money, the soft money goes. If you leave a loophole anywhere, it's like a balloon. You squeeze it here and it bursts bigger elsewhere. So looking at the big picture, trying to do that. And as part of that, because not everybody participates in it, if your opponent does not participate in it, as our law already does with the portion it has, if your opponent spends more than the limit, you have the ability to spend more than the limit too. So we give you a chance to compete with it. One last thing before opening it up for discussion, constitutionality. Why do we talk voluntary limits? Why do we need a subsidy in voluntary limits? The courts have said very clearly, you can't just mandate spending limits and contribution limits. Contribution limits they've been much more favorable to than spending limits, but they have said that they want them to be voluntary. They've left some loopholes. Early 1900s, Charles Evans Hughes, a former Supreme Court Chief Justice, had, before he went to the Supreme Court, he had staffed a New York legislative committee, and they had documented corruption by insurance and railroad interests in the late 1800s. And they wrote long, scathing reports on the corruption and justified some campaign limits on that, and the courts upheld them. And they used that in the 1950s on cases saying, you've got to document it. And Buckley-Vallejo, the biggest Supreme Court ruling on this issue, is throughout a lot of the federal and state reforms in the 70s, they said very clearly, you have not justified the need for this. You have to document it. So I think in any major reform, you have to show how money talks and show that it's corrupting the process and it's, and the appearance of corruption is destroying confidence. But the courts have said several things about it, and I think we can go further than we have, but the biggest problem is politically, interests like to give money because it gives them an advantage. Both sides, most issues do, it's not an equal amount, but both sides or many sides of many issues like giving money because it gives them an edge compared to others in the system. With that, I'd like to stop talking about it and start opening it up for discussion. Challenge things I say if you don't like it. If you have questions about it, I welcome questions, discussion, however it flows.
Anyway. I just wonder, you know, if I write a letter, mm-hmm. which I do, how much influence does this carry when others have professional trained lobbyists present much of the time and are shoveling vast amounts of money, you know, compared to my single sheet?
Well, you're obviously, a single sheet of paper is not going to have as much clout. I mean, I'm with the 88% who think politicians do pay more attention to people who make campaign contributions than people who do not. And I think it's obscene that we allow that to happen. I think it's human nature that it happens. And frankly, a lobbyist who's working full time on an issue and you're writing one letter, well, they're putting a lot more effort into it than you are. And the advantage of your letter is if it's one of many, can have an impact. It depends how politicians often operate on fear. If you're afraid, hey, the public really cares a lot about this, they're going to bend how they treat the issue. I was talking last night, and we'll talk more tomorrow about how you can have influence. A form letter doesn't do nearly as much as a very powerful argument or story. Here's what the situation is. Here's what the problem is. Please listen to this. And maybe not just writing the letter, but again, if you write a letter to a city council member in a city of 3,000 people, they don't get a lot of letters. And your letter is going to have a lot more impact there than it's going to have in a legislative district by district, 80,000, 75,000 people. One letter has less impact than if there are only 3,000 constituents. A congressional race, 500,000 people, a California state senate race is 500,000 people. One letter gets kind of swallowed up quickly, and presidential or U.S. Senate races, I mean, it's even more swallowed up in. People don't have a time. The President of the United States does not read every letter that comes into the White House, obviously not. And you wouldn't expect him to. He wouldn't be doing anything else if he was doing that. But certainly the money, my whole point is not that lobbyists shouldn't be allowed to make their case. If you and everybody in this room want to get together and hire a lobbyist to make the case for whatever issue you care about, you should be able to do that. And they're going to have an advantage over you as an individual. But my point is, let's take the money aspect out of it. I mean, well, they'll still have money in terms of they'll be spending money getting the person there and all the expenses of keeping somebody there. But that individual concept that a paid professional is there making campaign contributions to people they're trying to sway and the other advantages they have, I think it's obscene. Distraction from our democracy.
Yes, well said.
But you do have ability to do it. Writing the letter is better than not writing the letter, unless you're good at offending people. Then maybe.
I was obsessed by what was happening with these brokerages and the investment banks. You know, Merrill Lynch criminality and various others. I have my money with Fidelity, and I wrote a personal letter to Mr. Johnson. I said, you know, please live up to the name of your company. And, you know, with several paragraphs, and darn if I didn't get a personal reply from Mr. Johnson, CEO of Fidelity. I felt very good about that. He listened.
Do that. Yeah. I remember when Lee Iacocca was head of Chrysler and had this reputation for listening, I wrote after we had purchased a Chrysler that had some Plymouth that had some real problems 20-some years ago, and the dealer came broken, and we had terrible problems, and I said, you know, I'm willing, it was after warranty stuff and everything, all I want is a solution to this, just tell me what dealer will fix it, I'm tired of paying for non-fixes. Lee Iacocca, I never got anything more than a sort of nasty letter from some underling, but what you do is, if I had written three more letters, you know, I probably would have gotten through at some point. Persistence pays.
So what strategies do you use, how do you win elections? In this system, I mean, somehow or other, you know, people hear you.
Yeah. So I'm, well, I mean, the biggest difference, yeah. How? Why have I won? And I'm Democrat in a Republican district. Why have I won? Well, it's when I said how money determines not only who wins but who runs for office. I'm not going to run for U.S. Senate. There's no way in the world. I mean, I don't have $10 million. And basically, that's the kind of money that's being spent that way, and I won't take the money, and not the big stuff, and I couldn't raise it through the smalls. I raised over $1 million in $100 and less contributions, but $1 million and a lot of work. $1 million and $10 million is a big difference. And in local races, like we had a legislator, a guy here from somewhere in Northwestern Washington that was a legislator in the 70s for a few years, and he was a pharmacist in their house districts here, apparently fairly small. He said, yeah, I didn't have to spend much. Everybody knew me, everybody else. And the smaller the turf, the easier it is for a candidate who works to get known and get their message out. And again, Minnesota, I would argue that lots of candidates of both parties could live by my standards with the no big money stuff. Because we do have spending limits, we do have contribution, we have public subsidies that go in there and make it easier to raise money. We have an ability to do it. I don't know if I could do it in a New York state. I couldn't do it in a New York state or California, both because of the size of the districts and the amount of money being spent. Wisconsin now, I think, has had a couple of $1 million state senate races. I think same in Washington state. It's relatively small states are getting massive spending, and then you just write off the process unless we change it, which is why I think Bill Moyers has often spoken out on this, and I think I used to talk about how, yeah, campaign finance stuff isn't the biggest issue because it's certainly education, healthcare, environment, tax, policy, everything is has more direct impact on people's lives. But indirectly, this influences all of that. And I do think in many ways that, you know, if we care about our democracy, we better do something soon, because it's not one person, one vote, it's money talking.
What's your feeling among your colleagues about this kind of proposal?
I've got a reputation among colleagues as the gift ban that I authored has been in law for like 10 years. The public may know there's a ban on gifts. They don't pay a lot of attention to it. It's known at the Capitol, and I heard Minneapolis City Hall and some other places, as the, quote, goddamn Marty Law. They don't like it. They don't see any need for it. Well, a lot of them, oh, yeah, but two candidates for attorney general about 4 or 5 years ago, neither of whom won, were at a forum with me. A very conservative group was having a forum on the gift ban. It was me and those two, plus a lobbyist, and plus another lobbyist who was the moderator. And so it was sort of 4-1 on who thought the gift ban was a good idea, the moderator being on their side. And the audience was clearly with me. And the two attorney general candidates both said some things about how the gift ban was ridiculous and overkill and everything else. And a reporter who happened to be there wrote something about that. And they both were tripping over themselves writing jointly, these two opponents, jointly writing a letter to the editor saying how, oh no, you misinterpreted what we were thinking. We don't want to overturn the gift ban. We just want to modify it in some ways to make it more, quote, reasonable. colleagues, the biggest issue is a lot of them will grumble about the process, but I know one legislator from Minneapolis who buried one of the lowest income districts in the state, and the person happened would win no matter what she did, but anyhow, she relies heavily on PAC money contributions and other things. She hates this reform. Oh, means I have to raise all this small country. Everybody sees any restrictions as, oh, that's going to tighten me down more than ever. Never going to hurt my opponent. It's always going to hurt me. And if you see something where you provide something in advantage to, oh, look how much this can help my opponent, never it's going to help me. And so it's always it's a bizarre, sort of a paranoia type of thing. I once heard somebody say there's no such thing as paranoia in politics because, quote, they really are out to get you. But politicians very much feel, I got here under this process. You change the process, what happens? And so undoing some of the changes that have been made in the past, reforms even that have been done in the past, I think there's skittishness to address it, but anything to go any further is very unpopular too. And it's very tough to do. After 1992, Ross Perot swept the nation with, I don't know what he got, 20% of the vote or whatever, which was impressive. And there was a group called United We Stand America, which was the Perot folks. In Minnesota, it tended to be a lot of retired guys who hadn't been active in politics, and angry people who hated government, hated everything else. And they came in, they liked my bill. That was the year I was pushing hard for by total reform, and because I chaired the committee at that time, I was able to give my bill a hearing, and because the committee didn't like it, we spent more hearings on that bill than any other bill in state history in one committee. Why? Well, they couldn't kill it because the reporters kept paying attention, and this United We Stand guys were sitting around the room, and every time somebody tried to do something, reporters all come running up to the room and listen, and they'd kind of bail out and back off. And United We Stand folks, when they came to me, said, we want to endorse your bill. I said, well, you know, this bill has some more public funding in it. And United We Stand and Ross Perot folks were anti-anything government. And I thought, and I said, you know, this means public money means not only the candidates you like, but the candidates you hate are going to get public money out of this. But I think you can't just say, oh, we're going to take out this money and not replace it with anything else. You have to have both for the incentive and have a way that people can run a campaign where they can get their message out. You have to have some public money. And so I'm proposing some more public money in addition to this in exchange for this. Now, I'm happy to have your endorsement for that, but just so you understand, I think it's a package that works together and it doesn't work without it. And they I met with them, met for a half hour explaining all that, and they left the room, and 20 minutes later they came back and said, we strongly support your entire bill. And they were there every hearing, these old 70-year-old guys sitting in the room demanding reform. And we did get some reform that year, very reluctantly, because people were scared of, there had been a scandal the year before. And the year after we passed a portion of what I wanted, the gubernatorial contribution maximum was $60,000 15 years ago, then we lowered it to 10,000. My bill, I was trying to lower it to $100, and we ended up with $2,000. So they say, oh, you got more than halfway there, but we have a way to go. But, and we didn't do enough, the soft money flow is still there. We have more and more independent expenditures by the parties. So in some races where they're spending them, for a house race in Minnesota, like $27,000, we've had races where interest groups and the parties spend more than $300,000 in one race. And that's a major loophole. It wasn't there 10 years ago, but it's a court decision and then parties taking advantage of it. They just dump money in. And so the law is getting worse without changing the law. We have to change it just to keep up, but I think we have to go for it.
You made a comment earlier, the comment about the balloon. You close one part off and the other part puffs out. Well, I mean, that, I don't know how common the perception is, but the perception I have that actually regulating party donations or candidate donations is really almost impossible. There are so many very clever people out there just waiting to find that next loophole. And I'm just wondering, what are the possibilities of a totally publicly financed process?
Okay. You could do that. Matter of fact, several states have done that. There's a group that's proposing a similar thing in Minnesota. Minnesota has a law that it's a version of what was in place when I got elected, but it had been changed several times since then. That basically small contributors can get refunds on their contributions. An individual can give $50 to a candidate or a party that agrees to abide by the spending limits, participating candidate, which, as I said, virtually 100% of legislative candidates and 90-some percent of gubernatorial candidates have abided by, and they can get a dollar-for-dollar refund up to $50 a person. Democrats supported that, Republicans did not. Both parties use it. Republicans have actually taken better advantage of it. And you try and repeal it, and both parties oppose repealing it this year. I'm sorry, I'm dropping the question yet. What about stopping the money?
It was a poorly.
I've forgotten how I got into this. But the thing is, I have not favored 100% public financing because I think I can go out there and spout off on whatever I want. I can be a crackpot, and there are plenty of crackpots in the process. And it's not government's job to determine who's a crackpot candidate or not. Right. But if you just say anything like that, okay, any crackpot can go there and raise a small match or get some signatures, and with a few bucks, you can get people sign anything.
Yeah.
And you get a few signatures or a few small contributions, and you get public subsidies. And okay, well, hey, you buy all your computers, you buy all your anything you want, you can get $1 billion, depending on the race you're running for, you can get a lot of money to spend as you wish, pay yourself to be a candidate. I think you have to be, the states that have tried it, they've moved in that direction. They've got some good things in it. I'd argue my proposal is better, but I take this refundable contribution and allow it to continue and basically provide a little more public money, a little bit tighter contribution limit. And if your opponent skips the limit and they spend more than the limit, then you get more in the public subsidy to match it. And frankly, I know that works because when I first got elected, I told you my opponent skipped the limit. 2 years later, I carried a provision saying, if your opponent skips the limit, you get to keep the public money, you get to skip the limit too. And the opponent said, oh, that means everybody's going to be skipping the limits. No, I mean, it doesn't work that way. Nobody skips the limits because the incentive is even greater for you to do it. And I said, Ted Mondale, who could come in with $250,000, did it. But nobody else, not a single other candidate I know of in 15 years.
I didn't follow your refund. Make a contribution to get a refund. What is that?
In Minnesota, one part of our, we have two forms of public financing. One is based on people check a box on the tax form. It doesn't cost them money, so we use public money. And then in exchange for abiding by the, our limit this year is, last year was 56,000 or something.
So you get a tax refund.
And no, it's, no, that's the separate, this first portion of it is, if I agree to the limit, I received about $12,000 in public money, period. Just because I'm major party candidate, and we have a loose standard on major parties, so the Green Party and the Independence Party, so we have four major parties. If you're a major party candidate, you win the primary of that party, and you're agreeing to the limits, you get the amount that, in my case, was 12,000 out of 55,000. My opponent got the same amount. And, so we both got somewhere between $11,000, $13,000 in public money. Then, if you make a campaign contribution, if you're a Minnesota voter, you make a campaign contribution to me, you can legally give, I think, up to $500 now to Senate candidate. You, if you gave me $500 or if you gave me $50, you would get actually a refundable credit from the State Department of Revenue, as long as I'm a candidate who's abiding by the spending limits. And that's public money. So it's a very, I'd argue it's a creative thing to raise money for a candidate. It's small contributors who do it, and frankly, I think we should ban anything over $100. So I don't mind, if I'm somebody who wants to give $50 to you and $50 to you and $50 to you, different candidates, I only get one $50 refund a year, or a couple of $100. But a couple gets $100. But if you, so it's very much a public subsidy, but it's determined by, you have to get the support. It's amazing hard to convince people in Minnesota that you could write me a $100 check if you're a couple and you could get $100 back. What kind of, it doesn't believe it. They don't believe it. So it's a sell. You got to convince people it works. And obviously you have to convince them to, it takes them something to write name and signature on a check. And so it's some work to do that, but it's, I think it's a cheaper and more efficient way of determining which candidates have enough credibility that they deserve a public subsidy. And I do think basically publicly financed elections are a whole lot cheaper for the voters than, you know, what we have now. The system we have now, it's one decision in Congress can mean tens of billions of dollars for an industry. And they, businesses have learned in the last few years, and that's why money is flowing so fast. And the energy industry giving to Bush administration, who wrote the energy policies? I mean, they don't believe we have global warming, despite what scientists, not 100% of scientists have, but 90-some percent of scientists agree we've got the global warming problem, and how fast and how serious and how everything else may be under some dispute. But energy industry doesn't want us to think we have any global warming problem policy. And you make campaign contributions. To me, it's a great investment if you're a business. A few $1,000 in campaign contributions can pay off millions of bucks in benefits. And this insurance company in Minnesota, I think, is a perfect example. But I do like public finance campaigns. I just think you can do it more efficiently than the states have tried to have.
I also appreciate what you said about the, even if the money doesn't, change someone's vote, but the appearance of that, and I think that's also very important. They do polls, like, I don't know where I saw this, but they're actually, there's some statistics on people's perception of corruption in countries around the world. And corruption, people's perception of corruption is very high, especially in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Mexico for a year, and I know that the people are very, very often, it's very, people don't feel a part of the system. You know, alienated from the system because, well, finally this, I guess it was in 2000 or some, or around there, finally they had the same party out of the president's office
right.
for the first time in 70 years. So people are getting more involved again, but there's a feeling of things are corrupt, we can't change anything. And when you have that kind of a feeling, people quit,
you move from critical to cynical, meaning you drop out of the process. And that same Common Cause poll I cited in Minnesota, 88% thinking more, 88 to 6, more than 10 to 1 margin, thinking candidates are more likely to respond to a contributor than whatever. Well, of the people, they polled people in that same poll, people who had not voted in the previous year's presidential race, which I think was the 96 election, people who had not voted in the last presidential election, who admitted it. I mean, there are probably twice as many people who didn't vote in it than will admit they didn't vote. People, oh yeah, I'm sure I voted, yeah. No, of course they didn't vote. They couldn't have all. But amazing, and when you win, it's amazing how many people voted for you. Oh, everybody voted for you. But the self-reported people who said, no, I didn't bother to vote, why not? And well, of those, it was like well over half of them said that their belief that their vote doesn't count because money talks in politics was a major, if not the main factor in why they don't bother to vote, because they think their vote doesn't make any difference, why bother? So, and I'd argue, despite, yeah, I think the perception of corruption is bad because it destroys it, but I don't think it's just a perception, as some of my colleagues think. If so, you just run a good PR campaign to say, hey, it's not true. But I think it is true. I mean, I absolutely think Bill Moyers is right. It's the biggest problem in our democracy. One last question.
Yeah, sorry, John. Earlier, did you really say that it takes $10 million to run for U.S. Senate?
In a lot of states, in most states, I think it would be the case. Wow. Well, last year's race, I think there was probably in Minnesota Senate race, and again, there were other things happening, but the candidates themselves did not have $10 million. Well, actually, I think they may have, but I think the total amount last year's race may have topped $25 million in Minnesota between the parties and the candidates.
Are there spending limits on?
No, nothing. At the federal level has no limits.
Oh.
There are only a handful of states that have anything. Minnesota was probably the first, and I worked very aggressively in the early 90s and had some big progress after about 6 years of trying. When I told you how my committee, I chaired the committee, and my committee didn't want to pass the bill out, but they couldn't kill it because people were watching. They learned later on that, oh, you know, whenever there's controversy, the reporters and others pay attention. So just sit there silently while I present a bill. And I had bill after bill over these years. I present a bill, and they may ask a question and make it look like they're paying attention, and then in the end, okay, all those in favor, the chair take the vote, and all those in favor, aye. And I'd say aye, and maybe one other person. Those opposed, no. And I learned, I got asked for roll call votes in committee, so they're recorded votes, but even then they just figured, hey, just do it, nobody will pay attention. And the only reason we passed that reform in 93 and the gift ban in 94, the only reason was, one, they were fighting it, and two, the media was paying attention. And I can't persuade, it's not by power of persuasion with my colleagues, it's only by getting the public riled up. And this new scandal this year, we've got two scandals in Minnesota the last couple months, it seems to me we may actually have some chance to make progress again next year.
Well, anyway, thanks for the scandals.
Yeah.
Thanks for the scandal, yeah. No, it's sad. I mean, why can't we just do it because it's the right thing to do? Why do we have to prove what happens if you don't? Yeah. One last thing that we've
heard. You know, I'm from Minnesota, and on a positive note, when we talk about lobbying, you know, I work with a nonprofit that has a real small budget, and, you know, I'll tell you, we bring in $50,000 a year. But I know we make a big difference. And we have tremendous access at the state level, and I don't know how it is in everybody else's states, but we're really lucky in Minnesota. I mean, like John's office and other offices, people can just, you can walk right in there and talk to anybody. And it's amazing, you know, I think a lot of that excess of lobbying money is wasted, because if you can get a group organized, and a small group, it doesn't have to be a huge group of people, but at the state level, a small group of people, if they can get a presence there. And
The only thing I'll add to the change, modify that is, one, if they've got a compelling argument, yours on ATV and off-road vehicle damage to state forests, was something that angers a lot of people. And I'd say the arguments were very heavily on that side. And even so, we passed some things in the Senate on it, the Polaris and Arctic Cat, two biggest manufacturers in the country who both happen to be in Minnesota, they lobby and they win. They won 9/10 of what they wanted. Yes, you can have an impact. I mean, that's the whole point. Writing letters, doing organizing, you can have an impact. Certainly a lot of lobbying money is wasted, but there's so much of it. And it's not just the lobbying money, it's the campaign contributions that in the end drive a lot of public policy. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I hope this was helpful, and I'm happy to talk more in the next few days about it. Thank you.